Okay, it's with great pleasure I'm introducing Andreas, who is on the screen already. He's in San Francisco, so it's mid-morning. Andreas Weigand studies people and the data they create. He is an expert on the future of big data, social mobile technologies, and consumer behavior. Over the decades I have known him, I always admired his consequent position on transparency.
That he also fully lives. He has his complete up-to-date itinerary on the internet, so you can look up where he is and will be at what time, at least you think you know. But yeah. Andreas studied physics and philosophy in Karlsruhe, then in Cambridge, by the way, in the same year, and college with Larry Lessig, great year, and in Bonn, received his PhD at Stanford and taught at Stanford, UC Berkeley, and several universities in China. He founded the Social Data Lab at Stanford, which you can look up, Google, and then go there. He lives in San Francisco, as I said. He worked with lots of global clients, including Alibaba, Best Guy, Goldman Sachs, Lufthansa, SAP, Thomson Reuters, and the World Economic Forum, as well as with many startups.
He wrote the book Data for the People that is available in 8 languages. He was Amazon's chief scientist, where he helped create the firm's data strategy and customer-centric culture. We earlier saw this is one of the positive
windows. He also advised Angela Merkel and Olaf Scholz as a member of the Digitalrat, the Digital Council of Germany. Topics he spoke about at TEDx / and Swift innovation conferences include identity and trust, which is a topic we will also look at, data, the new rules, the data dilemma. In his 2020 conversation with Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman at the Aspen Institute, they pointed out that people in different parts of the world have very different opinions and concerns about data. In what he calls the social data revolution, he detects a deep shift in how people make purchasing and lifestyle choices. And so I am happy Andreas agreed to sharing his insights with us today on this new reality of social data.
So I'm just going to introduce myself and say that I'm a statistical parrot. I just string sentences together which seem to make sense on a relatively short coherence length, but maybe make no sense in the whole picture. But then, with Ulf saying that I'm a physicist, I think I can't get away with that anymore. So I am a physicist. Now my question is, what is a physicist? At an interdisciplinary center, I think it's important to understand that the different disciplines need to be good in their own strength and not just say, well, you know, we are not that good, but as an ensemble, we are good. So in my view, a physicist is a person who builds models. And what's a model? The key decision of a model is what is inside the model and what is outside the model, the noise, which I'm not going to talk about. A physicist makes predictions, they have hypotheses, and then at the heart, they run experiments. I was an undergraduate in Bonn, but my work was at CERN in Geneva, where we did at the time the largest experiments anybody did in the world. And that was fascinating to me. And actually, at the heart of it, I'm really a data guy. I love to know what data can we collect. And as Ulf said, I'm interested in people and data, and I'm particularly interested in data about people. giving in the spirit of the center here, a perspective I want to also bring in my very fortunate undergraduate education as a philosopher. I minored in philosophy and I focused on Immanuel Kant. And three leading questions I have for my presentation here. Was kann ich wissen? What can we know? Was soll ich tun? What shall I do? And was ist der Mensch? What does it mean to be human? And this last question I think is particularly interesting in this age of AI, of, you know, me saying, what differentiates me from a statistical parrot? If I look back on my research, starting with my undergrad work, my thesis was at Stanford in neural networks. And specifically, I looked at what is the objective function the neural net should optimize. That was with David Rummelhardt, who invented neural nets. It was in the 90s. And that still is my belief. What is the Zielfunktion, the target function, the objective function we should be optimizing? At this stage, with exponentially more data than we had it then, and exponentially more compute power than we had it then, optimization is easy. The hard part is to figure out what are the terms that should be in that function. One of my roles as chief scientist at Amazon was to work with Jeff Bezos to figure out the, what we call then, fitness functions or the objective functions for each team. And we were very clear. If you have an organization with, at the time, about 1,000 very smart people, if we get the objective function wrong, they'll find ways around it. And so that objective function is something which I think needs to be discussed. At the end of my talk, I'll be talking about data literacy. So I'll return to this item at the end of the talk, and I'll talk about the trade-offs and how we, as individuals, as citizens, and as society, how we should be responsible for understanding what we have in our objective function. All right. I thought I will give you a few examples from my own experience from the last year with data and society. The first example is a very controversial piece of software called ClearView AI. Here's how it works. You take a photo of somebody, a face picture, and you feed it into the application, and the application returns to you pictures of what the application thinks is the same person and the corresponding URLs of those pictures. So I obviously started with a picture of myself, a new picture. Nobody else had ever taken that picture, just taken my phone and uploaded it, and wow, 107 pictures got returned. One of them wasn't me, no resemblance to me. I don't know how that happened, but 106 were pictures of myself. Each of them with a corresponding URL from which website they got the picture from. Okay, next, I take a picture of my roommate. Same thing, lots of pictures about him, and he was surprised. I took a picture of my assistant. I had lunch the day, I went to a cafe, and just with my regular iPhone, I took a picture of a couple sitting maybe 8 meters away from me. And as I was leaving, I said in passing to them, you know, I'm Andreas, I did a book, Data for the People. I'm just doing a little experiment. And I was, no, here, is this you? And the guy was shocked. And his partner just grabbed my phone and said, you must delete it right now. Not understanding that it was not my phone where the data sat, but it was at Clearview AI. This experience that we completely lost privacy as soon as we step out on the street, people who have access to that app and other apps will know pictures of ourselves and what they conclude who we are. That was a deep realization which spawned the topic of my annual Social Data Lab workshop, which you can find at socialdatalab.com, where we had some very good people. Brewster Kahle, who runs the Internet Archive here. Lisa Lin, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, has an amazing book out called Surveillance State. Former student of mine, Claudia Perlich, all very smart people discussing what their data fears are. So you can watch it or look at the transcript at socialdatalab.com. And that, as I said, was inspired by my own deep experience of, for a month, using Clearview AI for everything. Maybe I give you a sketchy example. You know, I thought it's not only limited to people who are with me here in person. So I went to my favorite porn site and took a picture of my favorite model there and uploaded it to Clearview AI. And again, within a second, it said, here's this picture and here is the URL, and it was Cornell Rocket Science. Wow, so he's at Cornell. So went to Cornell Rocket Science, but he wasn't on that page. But then we have the Internet Archive. So went to archive.org and boom, there, the previous version of Cornell Rocket Science, there was his picture and his name. I hit him up on Facebook. We had a wonderful conversation, and he's a law student at actually a Larry Lessig institution right now. And, you know, there is no privacy. And even I, who should have known better, was shocked by these experiences. Okay, that was example number one. Basically, lots and lots and lots of data, billions of photos acquired, and the rest is simple algorithms. Now, example number two. Example two is an app which I think you should all play with. It is called otter.ai. So if you go to weigand.com/otter, so weigend.com/OTTER, you get a month free or something like that. And what it does is, it does language transcription. So I basically turn Otter on when I get up in the morning, and like on right now. And what it does is, it transcribes in real time what I'm saying. You know, the screen is probably not good enough for this, but it is amazing. It is amazing how it works. How does it work? It is one big neural net. It's very interesting how 20 years ago, we were thinking about language processing and how we need to use hidden Markov models to build invariances and timing and so on and so forth. None of this matters anymore. one net with many, many parameters, and you just feed it a speech signal, and it does an amazing job. I think nothing beats playing with it. So ClearView AI, of course, you can't play with. Otter, you can. And I think you'll realize how that is changing your life. The book Ulf mentioned, if I grab the English version, starts with the prologue with a story about my dad in prison in Bautzen in East Germany under the Stasi. And the title is When Everything is Recorded. And I just think we need to get comfortable with that assumption that as we walk through the world, something, someone is recording whatever we say. And it's not just recording, but what it really is, it is the, in this case, transcription that Otter makes it suitable forever. Think about it. How will that change your behavior? Whatever you say. Sometimes it might even be worth to having it on in your sleep. And you might be surprised what you are saying in your sleep. So that's about what you say. The third example is about where you are. I love a company called Life 360, LIFE360.com. And I know we are not really set up for doing good screen sharing here, but maybe I should just see whether if I show you the screen, we'll have some success. Here, if I go to Live 360 and I click on this, here's an example of my friend. My friend is in Arizona right now, and he is moving with 7 miles per hour. And you can completely zoom in into the record, into the resort. They are actually right now having a retreat for Life 360. Or if I look at my own history, it tells me basically wherever I have been at whatever point in time. I view it as augmented intelligence. And once you have this running every day, you'll be surprised about how much you're using it. In so many cases, you know, I can't remember quite where was I then. Well, Life 360 remembers for me. So those are the three examples I wanted to give on who you are, what you say, and where you are, how in your pocket the world has changed, and not primarily because of data, but I would say the world has changed, but not primarily because of algorithms, but because of the data we create and the data, you know, others collect, whether we know it or not, whether we want it or not. The last example I was going to use is GPT-3. I had last year, or maybe even the before last year, the chance to play with it excessively. Sam Altman is a friend of mine, and he just said, have fun and go for it. And it is amazing how good it has become. At the time, it really was just putting together random sequence of sentences, and I was deeply unimpressed. But now, and I think the API is open for anybody, again, I encourage you, play with it and then ask yourself, where are the boundaries between people and computers? I mean, obviously, for all of us, Google knows way more than we ever do ourselves. And I invite you to imagine a week without Google. Well, by the way, how much would be paying for not having Google switched off for a week? That's sort of the value you should think about, the value of data, the value of Google for you. And that's, of course, with ads and monetizing eyeballs, the business model we are in. Okay. So what have we learned from these examples? What I have learned from these examples is that as a curious person, despite living in Silicon Valley and knowing people in these companies and working with them, I am still amazed about how far technology has come. Maybe I should mention one other example. Since I told you I'm interested in geolocation, Life 360 is about the geolocation of people represented by their mobile phones. There's a company called Zainar, Z-A-I-N-A-R, which does geolocation of things. And it completely blows me away how they know on an accuracy of 30 centimeters, which is the time of flight of 1 nanosecond of light, where things are. If you knew where everything was in this world at a given point in time, how would that change your behavior? Think about manufacturing, think about supply chains, or think even about your house. If I knew where everything is in my house, I mean, it would save me a lot of time searching for things. Zainar.com. So what was unthinkable a few years ago is now reality in our fingertips. What do we do? The reason I wrote this book, Data for the People, is that I'm worried. I'm worried that this data of the people and data by the people will be used as data against the people. You might be wondering, what is he talking about? Well, let me give you an innocent example. Insurance. Health insurance. If the minuscule data about my behavior was used to compute, for instance, I just got an Oura ring. I'm going to get married next week, and we thought, you know, we'll have to wear a ring, so we'll do Oura rings. And that's quite interesting because that ring measures everything. How you sleep, when you sleep, and so on and so forth. So I don't have a problem with my partner knowing those things. But what about the health insurance? If I develop some symptoms of some disease and they will say, well, you know, your insurance rate will go up quite a bit. Well, and they don't have to explain why they increase the insurance rate, then I think things get very unfair. So that is one way how data of the people and by the people can get used against the people, one specific way. Other examples could be if you want loans from banks and so on and so forth. So we need regulation that doesn't allow action based on data that is essentially against the individual. Another example of what I see as data literacy is to understand where are there true trade-offs in data in the objective function, and where are there false trade-offs, where organizations and maybe governments try to make you believe that there is a trade-off in order for you to take certain actions which are in their interests, but not in your interests. Nobody said this better than David Brin in The Data Dilemma, that we all want privacy for ourselves and accountability for everybody else. That is a true dilemma. It's not something which you can hope to resolve magically, but this is something which we as society need to understand. Having worked as a member of the Digitalrat, the German Digital Advisory Council, with Angela Merkel and her team, I have realized that people are trying to do the right thing, but I think in many cases don't know what the right thing is. I am happy to try to help if people are interested. And I would like to give a pointer to a former student of mine, Tristan Harris, who has a whole nonprofit organization here where his goal is to actually increase awareness of the importance of the objective function. Tristan Harris here in Silicon Valley. I should give one example of where I should where I think digital literacy should go. One of the false trade-offs in this area of privacy and accountability goes in the area, and the intersection of medicine is when it comes to collecting data about people. I had dinner last night with a friend who works at Genentech. Genentech is part of Roche, and they make huge experiments to basically create drugs against cancer. And I told you about the worry that data can be used against us. But there are cryptological solutions, and the example I want to talk about here is called differential privacy. So crypto is not only used to get rich quick in the world of Bitcoin, etc., but can also be used in science. Differential privacy is an example of a crypto method that allows the person who is doing the experiment to access your data to whatever he needs for the experiment, but without ever having the ability to trace it back to the individual. So a keynote like this doesn't give me enough time to really explain how it works, but I want you to be aware that there are technologies that allow us to make progress in preserving privacy while allowing for research. And I think here in Konstanz, in the center, it is a good place for people to come together from different disciplines, law, psychology, sociology, technology, of course, and figure out what should be the case. So I talked about the Kantian questions. What can I know? And there, I think I'm pretty good in anything related data. What shall I do? More complicated. And was ist der Mensch, what is human, the question about AI in relationship to, say, GPT-3 in relationship to humans, very, very tricky one. I think in most cases, we overestimate how good we are. That's why I started saying I'm a statistical parrot. I want to end with Kant as well. And I want to end with the beginning of Was ist Aufklärung? What is enlightenment? A piece he wrote in 1784. And it starts with Habe Mut, dich deines eigenen Verstandes zu bedienen. Have the courage to actually use your own brain. I've noticed that in many areas, in the area of data and society, people are like lemmings. They don't really use their own brain, their own curiosity to actually play with some apps like the examples I gave you, Life 360 and Otter AI. But they just jump on the bandwagon of some populistic opinions, and I think that's very sad. being from Germany, having I was born in Freiburg, but having spent the last 30 years in the United States, and about maybe in months there, 4 years or so in the People's Republic of China in Shanghai, I think I have a relatively global perspective where I see where do people actually use their brains to come up with their own opinions. And, you know, not that anybody asked me for a recommendation here, but I would give you the same recommendation I gave Angela Merkel when she asked me, Herr Weigand, tell me, what do you think I should be doing? It's a recommendation I follow myself. Find a teenager, you know, the son or the daughter of your neighbor, of a friend. In my case, it's the son of the principal cello at the San Francisco Symphony. So there's some accountability. I know his parents. But, you know, I ask him once a month. We sit down for 1 hour. And we split the hour in 4 15-minute segments. We flip a coin who goes first. And let's say he goes first. He tells me for 15 minutes what he thinks I should know that I don't know. That is often looking at some apps where I just have no idea what they do and why they are there and why an intelligent teenager would spend their time on it. But I just sit there and listen. And then I have 15 minutes to ask him questions. And we time this. And then it's my turn to tell him for 15 minutes what I think he might not know, but that could be of interest to him. And then it's his turn to ask questions. And that's it. See you next month. So I think I learn a lot in those conversations, very bounded in time, but very outside the usual people I talk to, data scientists at the companies here. And that would be my advice. Spend an hour a month in a conversation where you can make a difference. And I promise the other person will make a difference in how you think about things. That's what I wanted to say in my talk. To summarize, I started with, I'm a physicist. What it means to be a physicist, I think it means to be able to measure things. Sometimes I say it means to be able to count and to divide. But the important thing is what to count and what to divide by. I said this dividing by is an example of the importance of the objective function. That's what we need to think about. What terms do we want to have in it? How do we, for instance, express fairness? A key topic in my book, Data for the People. I gave you three examples. Clearview AI, which was shocking to me, pointer at sociallabs.com, order.ai, which all of you can use, Life360, which all of you can use. And then at the end, went back to the question again of AI, of intelligence. And my view is that we tend to overestimate ourselves as humans. I'm very Wittgensteinian when it comes to language, then meaning equals use. And what to do about it? Increase data literacy. Teach somebody about maybe the value of data, the value of data being the decisions we made. Think about the data dilemma, those things which won't go away. And don't forget to use your own brain. Thank you for your attention.